This program has been made possible by cable members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with Basim Youssef, dubbed the Jon Stewart of the Arab world. He's the creator and host of the first political satire show in the Middle East. Tickets for this all-ages event with Basim Youssef on Monday, April 3rd at the Newmark Theater are available now at portland5.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
A time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning. The time is about 4 minutes after 8 in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, your very own community radio station. This is Positively Revolting, and I'm Ani.
And I'm Lynn.
This morning, we are going to be talking with Julie Scalfo. Julie is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, where her stories about how we live routinely appear in the Times' most emailed list. She's also been a correspondent of Newsweek, covering breaking news and writing about society and human behavior. She covered the events of September 11th, 2001, live from Lower Manhattan, and then reported extensively on attacks on the attacks' environmental and emotional aftermath. She believes radical empathy is where it's at. I love that. Good morning and welcome, Julie, to Positively Revolting.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, we are excited to have you on this morning. You are the author of the new book, Come and Ride Up,
The Women Who Made New York.
And you'll be actually speaking at Powell's to introduce that book on Sunday. We'll get to some details about that in just a little bit. But first, about the book. We were excited to see it's a wonderful history, and it's got wonderful illustrations by Hallie Held. And between your really engaging stories, little mini bios of so many notable women, women I've never heard of and women who are heroes of mine all together in one book, with these wonderful illustrated portraits, it's a great compendium of women who really made a mark in their world, especially in New York. And
well,
so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for saying that. The idea for this book was to do something a little different. It's not sort of your typical history book. You know, all of us don't have time to pick up a 400-page biography on every person that we're interested in. But what I wanted to do was make sort of an object, a book that was beautiful. It's a coffee table book. It's something that's nice to keep around, thanks to Hallie Held's gorgeous illustrations. But also, each biography is just meant to be a quick snapshot, you know, each story is, you know, from one page to maybe the max is 3 pages long, so that you could get a quick sense of what these women are like. And what I'm hoping it does is it raises awareness of these sort of untold her stories mm-hmm. That we've all been missing out on. And then, you know, if people are interested in these women, they can go on and read more biographies out there.
Absolutely. And I found that to be particularly engaging, particularly accessible, because as you said, many of us don't have time to read 400-page bios on every person that we're interested in, every woman that we're interested in. How did you cull who made it into the book and who didn't.
That was really the hardest part. The idea for the book originated with Seal Press, which is a small imprint of Hachette based out of Berkeley, and they only publish women authors. And the executive editor there, Laura Mazur, who I've known for many years, wanted to do this book and had a vision for it, and she thought the list would be just 25 women. So she asked me to she brought the idea to me. I absolutely fell in love with it. And when I began, thinking of names, I immediately came up with, 50, 100 names off the top of my head. And then I started doing my research, and I kept getting more and more names. And no matter who I cut out to get a list of 25, it just didn't feel right. The whole point of this was to finally kind of tell the stories about the hidden figures that had been overlooked. And so it really, first of all, I stopped sleeping. I had to, I was so upset about it, literally. I just didn't want to leave anybody out. But eventually, I talked to Louise Mayer, who's the president of the New York Historical Society, and she said, you know what, Julie, no one exhibit can cover all of history. We do 1 year or 1 month or one event. She's like, no one book can do that either. So I acknowledge right in the introduction that this is not meant to be a complete compendium of all the women in New York's history. There, unfortunately, are many women's names who are lost and will never, unfortunately, even get them. But this is meant to be a starting point and a way to start the conversation. So what I did is, for the women who made New York, I created about 40 different chapters, and each chapter is a facet of New York City life that I think is important. So there's a lot of obvious parts of New York, sort of iconic places like Wall Street or Broadway or Harlem. But another big part of New York, and this is one reason I'm excited to go to Portland, because it's a city with the same kind of energy, is all of the activists or all of the artists, all of the creative people, the counterculture people who invent their own ways of doing things and have their own innovative ideas about how to build a society that's more fair and just. So a lot of the women in my book were pioneers in social justice movements, early feminists, suffragists, people who fought for better understanding and relationships between different races, Barbara Giddings, who fought to get the American Psychological Association to remove homosexuality from the DSM so that it would no longer be seen as a disorder. And there were all of these women who came through New York and started in New York who created these social movements that were important to New York City's identity, so they're in the book, but then they really traveled from there out through the rest of the country. And so I think people in all cities, I hope, will be intrigued to learn about these women.
Well, I loved, hi, this is Lynn. And Julie, in your introduction to the book, you were talking about when you came to New York. And I spent a little time in New York during the 70s and the 80s. And people like yourself and Patti Smith, who came with, two nickels to rub together. And do you think that's sort of possible now? Things have gentrified to such an extent. We're having this problem in Portland, too. It used to be really easy to live here and
Question. I mean, this country has a real problem, right? We have the largest disparity between wealthy and poor that we've had in centuries. Throughout human history, feudal times, there was this kind of disparity, and it's a real issue. I think in New York, it's getting harder and harder for creative types to survive here. I know working people who have good jobs and solid incomes, but the amount of income is just not enough to keep up with rent costs. I lived for many years after college with multiple roommates. We divided the rent based on the size of your room, and I lived in the living room. I put a wall up that we made out of IKEA furniture. And I think people can still do that, but I think it's harder and harder to do that in Manhattan. So even Brooklyn has neighborhoods that are so gentrified, it's impossible to afford them. So I think what we're seeing is creative people are moving outward, and there's new neighborhoods in New York City where things are popping up. So, creative people will always find a way to survive and build their own communities, but it's definitely getting harder and harder.
Well, and just the character of the place. I remember my friend at the time lived in Brooklyn before. It was still Italians and Russian people, and I was there for Christmas, and I remember this woman walking down the street saying to me, "Have a happy." That sort of very New York thing that I'm feeling is probably not in Brooklyn anymore.
Well, you know, I live in Brooklyn, and it is
okay. Well,
there,
tell me about. Okay,
say.
Good. This
and
was
I'm delighted that I get to live in a neighborhood where there is still some of that old Brooklyn character. But the old and the new really bump up against each other in interesting ways. And I was one of those people who said I would never leave Manhattan. And after September 11th, I lived downtown. It was a really sad time for the city. And my husband and I, we were then dating, but we wanted to move in together. And I said, okay, I'll try Brooklyn. And I ended up loving it even more because it was like Manhattan used to be. You know, I used to live near Union Square in the East Village. And then, you know, there had gotten to be a Barnes & Nobles and a Babies R Us. I mean, Bleecker Street now is like a strip mall. It's all the same stores that you see everywhere in the country. So Brooklyn has retained a lot more of its character, but it also is experiencing gentrification. And it's also a really complicated equation because I know a lot of old school Brooklyn families who really benefit when the real estate prices go up and when the chain stores move in. So even though I want the mom and pop store to stay, you know, I know old families that are so grateful when Dunkin' Donuts comes in and offers them $10,000 a month in rent because they can't earn that, you know, making pizza. So it's complicated, you know, all of these questions about our city and our community. But one of the things I try to make clear in The Women Who Made New York, and I think this is where there's lessons for everybody all over the country, is the women in the book, they all really made their way by looking forward and trying to help other people. And, you know, President Obama had awarded Shirley Chisholm a medal posthumously, and he said, you know, there's some people who they don't look left, they don't look right, they don't look behind them, they just go forward. And she was one of those women, for example, and there was no representation for the Bed-Stuy community in government, and she ran for office, and she did it her way, and she just kept focused on what she needed to do. And it was so difficult for her. She was treated disrespectfully by male members of Congress. She faced a lot of difficulty in terms of finding financial support for her campaigns, but she just kept doing the work and doing the work, and the legacy that she leaves us is so important. So, you know, I hope people find inspiration in these stories, you know, whether it's from an artist like Laurie Anderson, who just, you know, followed her own drummer and her own path to figuring out how and where to make the art she wanted to make, to someone like Sarah Josephine Baker, who was an early public health physician, one of the first female physicians in the United States, and she went to work for the city health department and was instrumental in making New York City a safe place to live for babies and children, which used to die in these extraordinarily high rates because of the lack of hygienic, you know, services, you know, hygiene. There wasn't running water in the tenements, you know, mm-hmm. enough to take care of all these people. So she really made a difference there.
And for me also, it's like some names that, so I learned a lot about new women that I didn't know about, but I'd forgotten all about Diane Arbus.
Yeah, you know,
and she's such
Arbus.
A seminal...
Such what?
A, well, she was such a seminal photographer, and I was kind of young when I saw, I think it was at MoMA, a show that she had there, and I had never seen anything like that. So I just...
She was seminal. You know, I've always, I guess, been interested in female photographers, and there were so many important New York female photographers that I wanted to include about 10 of them. And then I realized, okay, how can I have 10 in a book about New York? So, you know, there are omissions, but she's included in the book as well as Berenice Abbott, who was so broke. She eventually got sponsorship from the WPA to complete her important project of landscapes of New York City. But Diane Arbus was someone who initially she worked as a photography assistant to her husband, and then she went out and she would go into places and into communities where you know, most mainstream photographers were ignoring. And so she would visit.
That's an interesting way to put that. Yes.
Yeah, well, she would live on the, you know, go to the streets of Coney Island, and people you think of, you know, that other people might call freaks. You know, she was like, who are these people? And she befriended them and made these amazing portraits that really show us all the different dimensions of human life.
Yeah, she was utterly amazing.
Amazing. So did you have any other favorites? There's a lot of food women in the book. I know Portland's a foodie town, and I felt like, I mean, for me personally, I live
yeah,
in
you
New
personally,
York
I'm interested in who you thought, who was your most interesting, I mean, who was your favorite? Can you pick, is that like picking a favorite child?
It's like picking a favorite child. Yeah. I can't. You know, revisiting Eleanor Roosevelt was thrilling. I mean, what a human being.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
She was a force of nature. The amount of work she did in her life, and when you really look at her accomplishment creating the Declaration of Human Rights for the UN, I mean, look at the political challenges we have in this country getting people to agree on a single bill or a complicated thing like health care. I mean, she endeavored to write the first ever statement on human rights that would be acceptable to, you know, most of the participatory countries in the world. It was so complicated. They stayed up days and nights. She had a team. She drove them like the fiercest, you know, employer, and they spent hours on this thing. And, you know, it's ever the more relevant now when we're living in a time where politicians are just dismissive about the importance of treating people with dignity. And so she's a hero of mine, and I loved revisiting her. But I also love learning about people I never heard of, like Eve Adams, who was a transgender woman.
I was just going to mention her. Yeah, exactly.
Before we even had the word transgender, mm-hmm. you know, she was trying to make space in society for women to openly talk about their sexuality. And that was something that just wasn't done. It wasn't allowed. And because there were people who didn't agree with it, at some point, someone told the police that there was indecent things happening in this cafe, and an undercover officer befriended her, and she showed her a novel she was writing that contained lesbian love scenes. And because of that, the officer arrested her, charged her with indecency, and she was sentenced to a year and a half in jail, which she served.
And
what was amazing is during that time, Mae West was arrested, spent just about 5 days in jail, and they met. And Mae West said to her, wait a minute, how is this right that I'm in here for a week because I'm a celebrity and you're here for a year and a half? But she served a year and a half, and then we deported her, even though she begged not to go. She was an immigrant here legally who said, I love this country. It's my home. I built a business here. And after we sent her back to Poland, where she had come from, she made her way eventually to Paris, where she was taken by the Nazis and murdered at Auschwitz. And it breaks my heart because it's, you know, an example of where our indifference to her situation led to her death.
Yeah, absolutely. And she was actually one of my the favorites in the book that I hadn't known about before. And considering the fact that I have studied queer history for so long, I'm a little stunned with myself that I had not actually known Eve Adams's story before. And
it was really hard to find information on her. There's very little out there. And actually, I was blessed to encounter a playwright who has done a ton of work on her and has written several plays about her. And she was kind enough to share some of this information that I'm giving you. It came from her research. You know, there's a lot of people whose names are lost to history. And if you yeah. look at the index of my book, we only included women. And when I first saw that, we considered the idea, I was actually uncomfortable with it because I said, wait a minute, we're leaving all the men out of my book. That's not right. Men were part of the story. We don't want to omit them, pretend they don't exist. But all of a sudden, I realized that when you go back and you look at most of this country's history that was written by men, and you look at all the indices, most of the names are men.
Yeah.
So where are the women? Did they not exist? We know they existed. And so they have been omitted over and over and over again. And that really is not just a distorted sense of history, but it's a false sense of history. We're missing all of this important information. And
well,
so,
and certainly when we think about the founding of cities, the founding of nations, cultural, you know, we always talk about the founding fathers, right? And so it's even just in the vernacular and how we frame things, women are omitted from the picture. So I think, you know, until that time, that great day that we all look forward to where that stops happening, to have a book that specifically highlights and celebrates the accomplishments and contributions that women make to the founding of a city or a nation or culture, you know, that this is really, really necessary, and it helps to fill in that really just stark gap.
I hope so. I've been really just delighted by the response to the book. A lot of young women, I mean, it's written for adults, but a lot of kids are picking it up and teenagers, and they're so excited to hear about these women who don't know existed. But also men are responding too. I mean, I think we are reaching a time in civilization where there are a lot of men who are comfortable in their masculinity and acknowledging, you know, a lot of dads of daughters are like, wait a minute, this is, how can we say there were founding fathers and not founding mothers? That's not true. That's not the full story. So let's get more of the story. Let's tell those stories. And so I hope the book is a beginning to do that. And also, I think, you know, we saw this film that just came out, Hidden Figures. You know, it shows how meaningful it is for all of us to get the full story, to get more information. It doesn't take away from the accomplishments of the men who did amazing things, like went to outer space. But how much richer and more accurate is it to know about the women who were involved in making that project happen?
It seems simple, doesn't it? It seems pretty logical.
Well, you know, I like to talk about this word perspective that I think we don't use enough in our society. Donald Trump has gotten a lot of attention and, you know, nodding heads from people when he talks about the fake media. And when he says that, I think he's using the wrong word. I think that sometimes what people see reflected back to them in media doesn't reflect their own reality, but that doesn't mean that it's fake. It's just not complete in its perspective. Any one news story, any one television story or radio interview is not going to give you the full picture. I can talk about my book for an hour, but nobody's going to have the same experience listening to me as if they actually pick up the book and hold it in their hands. And so one of the things I think we've become more aware of is that if you want to get closer to the truth, have the most complete truth possible, that you got to have multiple perspectives. The perspective you're going to get from a man is going to be different from a woman. If the perspective you're going to get from a white person is different than a person of color. Having people at different economic levels, ages, education levels. And so, you know, the best thing I think we can hope for to be an informed citizenry is take in information from as many sources as possible, not just rely on any one thing. And when we're studying history, I think it's really important to look at different sources of information. So, for example, I went to the New York Historical Society's archives. They have this amazing, beautiful library, and you could go back and look in some original documents. And it's very interesting to take those old documents and re-examine them. So, you know, one thing I did, actually this was just, I can't remember where I found this book, but Sardi's, Lou Sardi wrote a book about his restaurant. You know, it's a famous restaurant on in the theater district, and it's been popular with actors, you know,
forever.
For decades.
Yeah.
And it was always considered his restaurant. You know, it was he was the name associated, and his autobiography is called Sardi's, S-A-R-D-I apostrophe S. But if you read it, he makes very clear that it was his and his wife Jenny's restaurant. They came up with the idea together. They found the location together. She shopped for the food. She planned the menu. She cooked. As they got more successful, she did the hiring. You know, he ran the door. She ran the register. They were there together forever. And so it made me wonder, why wasn't it Sardi S apostrophe, right? It
right.
really was their restaurant. And that information was available to us, you know, to everybody all along. It's just our perspective on it that was different. It was seen as his restaurant, not as their restaurant. And so I think just reexamining the information we do have available can really help us have a more complete perspective.
You speak like a reporter.
I've been doing
I like
for
that.
A while.
I know.
So you are listening to Positively Revolting here on KBOO. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning we are speaking with Julie Scalfo, who is the author of The Women Who Made New York. She will be speaking at Powell's this Sunday. I want to invite you to call. Call 503-231-8187. And you too can get in on this conversation. Ask your questions, share your thoughts, ideas. Please do join us. And also, throughout the week, you can follow along on Facebook. You can like our page, Positively Revolting, or on Twitter, you can follow us at Positive Revolt. And with all of that said, why don't we go ahead and get some details? You are going to be at Powell's on
yep,
Burnside.
I'm going to be at Powell's. I'm so excited. I can't even believe it. It's going to be my first trip to Portland. So I
Oh, nice.
eager to devour the city and see as much as I can.
Well, if you love books, Powell's is the place to be.
Yeah, pretty much. I've heard all about it, and so I've been waiting a long time to get there. It's going to be Sunday night. I think it starts at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, they usually do.
I'll be there a little bit early to hang out, and people are welcome. It's a free event. I'll take questions. I'll talk a little bit about the making of the book. And, yeah, I'm just excited to meet people in the community there and share these women's stories.
Excellent. And that's, again, it's Powell's downtown. It's the Powell's on Burnside. We have a few of them because Powell's, it's just too great to fit into one or two city blocks.
Actually, it starts at 7:30.
7:30, yeah.
7:30.
And I just want to maybe talk a little bit about the book's illustrations. So you pair it up with Hallie Hild. Had you worked with her before?
I had never worked with Hallie. Hallie is a young artist who's phenomenally talented, and she's another sort of creative type who came to New York with a nickel in her pocket. And she, before she came to New York, she set a goal for herself to improve her painting. And she likes to do cartoons, but she wanted to do more portraiture that's realistic. And so she decided she was going to paint one portrait a day for a year so that she would have 365 images she could bring with her to the city. And she did it. And, you know, she earns a living being a freelance stylist and also taking commissions. And her website's pretty fantastic. And your listeners could check it out if they want. It's HEHEDesignsNY.com. And if you go to my website, JulieScalfo.com, there are links there, or through my Facebook author page, there are links. And she does commissions of people's pets and families and houses, and that's how she pays her bills. And this was her first book, and she loved working on it. And basically, I gave her the name of the names of the women that I wanted to be featured, and I would download to her everything I had learned about their biographies and sort of what they were like as people, you know, what their spirit was like. And then she would research them visually and look up as many paintings, photographs, videos, if they existed, as she could find, and try to sort of capture their essence in this one image, which is challenging to do. And what I love about what she did is sort of working from archive material, she would include little details that kind of spoke to their personality. But, you know, in most cases, it's not directly from a photograph. She would take the angle from one and the expression from another. And what I love so much about her work is that whether she was painting someone who's alive right now or who is three centuries gone, their energy, their spirit just really comes out of the image. And so, you know, the book, I think, is really beautiful thanks to Hallie. And I hope people enjoy sort of the art component as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I found her portrait of Yoko Ono more than delightful.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what one really cool thing that happened is Dr. Uma Meisterkar is featured in the book. She's an OBGYN who helped make the first Hindu temple in the United States in Queens, where she lived. And she sent me this beautiful note after she received her first copy of the book, and she said, you know, I'm so honored to be included. I'm really grateful that you have me, but I have to say, I don't quite understand, why did you choose that photo? It just doesn't exactly look like me. And I said, Dr. Meisterkar, that's not a photo, that's a painting, because it looks so much like it. She thought it was a photograph. So I thought that was kind of amazing.
That's great. And again, the artwork and the stories are so engaging. They really, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, a person from 300 years ago or somebody who is a contemporary, it really does sort of allow us to access who they were and to do it in these wonderfully tasty bite-sized pieces.
Well, you know, Yoko Ono was someone who obviously has had a big presence in New York for a long time. And I was born in the 70s. And so having grown up with a father who was, you know, a Beatles fanatic, I really knew her only in a secondary way because of her marriage. And once I started researching her work and learned about it, I realized just how ahead of her time she has always been and how profound her work as an artist, and the sort of quality and quantity of output that she has produced, her frequent contributions to political dialogue in New York City, the billboards she puts up for peace, all the many programs that she's done. You know, I just felt like I had to include her. She's such an important New York City figure. So it was interesting. I worked with her staff to, you know, fact check everything that I wrote and make sure I carefully described her work, because in conceptual art, you know, it's a very specific intention behind what she does. So that was really fun to work on, and hopefully I'll do an event with her at some point.
I know. I remember the I was in New York the Thanksgiving after, as George Carlin used to say, the explosion downtown. And she had, and it was the only, this huge black and white billboard. And I, where did, do you remember where she put it up?
Gosh, there, she's done many over
right,
the
this
years,
was the so first one I ever saw that just said, give peace a chance, because that was, you know, it's nice to have that message going out over people's heads every day, because things
were
very sad.
Yeah, well,
you
know, that's, a lot of her work is about changing your mindset and you will change the world. It's a very sort of Buddhist philosophy in a way that I think is useful to everyone to sort of change how they're experiencing their society and the world that they live in. And, you know, she's done so many amazing things, including a sort of fake show at the MoMA once, where she put up signs, you know, she put an ad in the New York Times inviting people to this exhibit. And then when they got there, there was no formally installed exhibit in the museum, but it was an opportunity for them to reflect on what exactly their concept of an exhibit was. And she had released bees, I believe, and encourage people to sort of follow them from the museum courtyard out into New York City. So that was kind of cool. And then many years later, of course, the museum did a true retrospective of her work. So that was a neat coming together.
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and bring in one of our listeners. Good morning, Emma. You're on the air.
Hi, Oni.
Hello,
thanks,
Emma.
The story about Eve Adams, that's, like, so amazing.
It's so amazing. I mean, she was such a brave person, and she was an early admirer of Anise Nin and Henry James, and she used to sell their books downtown. And also, it turns out that she later sold their books on the streets in Paris, and this was when not a lot of literary types were giving them credit. So she was a real free thinker. She was really interesting, and on her tea house there was a sign that said, "Men are admitted, but not welcome." And, you know, in the 1920s, there were a lot of different responses to this. Some of the poets in the village would hang out there, and they, you know, really liked going to her place and visiting. But there were, you know, people who were very, you know, riled up about not allowing anything that could be seen as, you know, inappropriate, and that's why the crackdown.
Did her book survive? The novel she was
Oh, that's such a good question. That's such a good question. You know, the playwright who wrote these plays about her has the most information of anyone that I've been able to find. Her name is Barbara, and I'm just quickly trying to remember her last name. But it's
Barbara Kahn or Klon?
Barbara Kahn, exactly.
Yeah.
Barbara Kahn might know. And actually, I remember now, someone told Barbara Kahn once that they had a copy and asked her if she wanted to see it, and then they never showed it to her. And so this thing might exist out there. But nobody that I know has ever been able to see it. So if you have a detective instinct, if you do, you should go for this thing and try and find it, because it would be amazing to find.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You can find it, Emma, and then share it with me.
Exactly.
Yes, it takes many people to bring up this information and then to spread it around. Thanks very much for your call, Emma. Let's go ahead and bring in Richard. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Here I am, a male, calling in to applaud your guest for her wonderful sounding book, which I will surely investigate.
Thank you.
And I'm just wondering, will you continue on and do the same thing for every other state in the country?
Well, you've asked the million-dollar question. While I was working on this,
laughing.
Gloria Steinem said to me, she said, Julie, why don't you do one for each borough of New York City? Because there's so many women. And I said I needed to finish this one first. But I have been approached about doing maybe a few other cities. And I really like this idea of maybe thinking not just about the country's founding fathers, but the country's founding mothers. And so maybe developing it into a series. You know, there's not a lot of money in book publishing for anyone. And I hired several researchers to help me because I didn't have a long amount of time to gather everything up. And so I would need to do that in other cities as well, especially because I don't have the knowledge. You know, I don't have enough personal knowledge of Chicago to know where to start. I've been around New York long enough that I had a Rolodex full of people who were experts in certain topics. You know, I know someone who's been covering New York real estate for 30 years, so I could call him for suggestions of organizations to research with, same with other categories. But I love the idea, and I don't know, would you want to read that? You think the appetite's there?
Oh, yeah. And but you're right. That's a lot. You've got a lifetime of work. All set out for you now.
I think so. But, you know, what's really cool is while I was working on this, an announcement came out from the New York Historical Society in New York mm-hmm. that they were opening the first ever Center for Research in Women's History. And next month they're going to open the fourth floor of the museum. The reopening has been redesigned for a permanent exhibit about women's history in New York and beyond. And Billie Jean King has donated her papers there. And, you know, more and more people are turning their eye to the past and looking at women's history. So, you know, there's no shortage of information. And, I don't feel any proprietary sense over this. I think it's wonderful. The more we have, the better. But, yeah, I am thinking about sort of my next project. And I think it will continue in this vein, although I can't say yet exactly what it'll be.
And I want to give our number out again. If you would like to join in this conversation, please do call 503-231-8187. We are speaking with Julie Skelfo. She is the author of The Women Who Made New York, illustrated by Hallie Hale, and a great book about really just influential women, some very famous, you know, Patti Smith, Mae West, Audre Lorde, you know, these names, Yoko Ono, on the tips of our tongues as purveyors of culture of any kind. But some, again, really not very well known and still so influential. And I'm so glad that you're bringing their stories to life as well. I'm curious. So this is not a a history that's written in a chronological order.
Yeah.
You have grouped the women sort of according to what they did, what they were known for. You know, you have the restaurateurs, you have you have hot stuff, where we would find the stories of Mae West and Eve Adams. But you also have the crooks. Let's talk about the crooks.
Well, you know, I get a lot of questions about the crooks. People are like, why did you include the crooks? You know,
what it's New York.
New York. Exactly. I mean, I just think you can't deny that the dark side of the city's history is there and that it's played a role in how we think about the city. It certainly inspired an endless number of comics and films and all of that kind of thing. And, you know, I also, as I talked before about perspective, I hope something people take away from this book also is maybe a new perspective on how they think about things. Mm-hmm. And so the women who were crooks in New York City often turned to that work because there were limited options available to them or because they were really good at it. And also sometimes we think of criminality in sort of this black and white sense, but it's not always like that. So, for example, Sister Ping is featured in that chapter, and she is someone who was considered by the FBI to be the worst snakehead in American history, and she used to bring people over from the Fujianese province where she was originally from in China and smuggle them into the country. Now, even though she used these horrible tactics to exploit them, charging them tons of money, and then when they didn't pay, she worked with a gang who would go and beat up their families and sometimes worse until she got paid, a lot of these people consider her a hero. They lived in desperate circumstances, and they remain grateful to her that she got them into the United States. And so it's this very interesting situation where, you know, you might think of her as a criminal, but at the same time, she also helped a lot of people. And so, you know, having a more robust perspective on that, I think, gives us a fuller picture. There's another woman, you know, you asked me to pick a favorite, which I won't ever say any are my favorite, but I really fell in love with Stephanie St. Clair, who was a mobster. She was a numbers runner up in Harlem. And at this time, the way it worked was the people who sort of ran these rackets also helped provide for the community. They paid for street fairs. They would spend the money to improve the playground. If someone lost their job and he couldn't feed his family, they would give them a loan and you know, help them out until they could get back on their feet. So they were very well regarded and by their communities. And then the most amazing thing happened that I had no idea about, which was once the white bootleggers who were in Midtown realized how much money was in Harlem, they tried to invade the space and take over. They were violent. There were crimes committed. And she held them off. She was fierce, and she was like, no, we're not going to have that mess in Harlem. The Italian-American mobsters had a lot of violence, and that's just not how she ran her business. And so she held them off, and I think that's an incredible story that more people ought to know about.
I'm curious. You have Lynn Stewart also in that chapter, and Lynn Stewart, for many of our listeners, and she was actually a guest on our show right before she was incarcerated. And I would never consider her a crook. I would consider her, you know, really one of the political. I'm not sure which chapter I would put her in, but I would never consider her a crook. So I'm curious about your thinking there.
Well, you wouldn't.
She also passed away about 2 weeks ago.
She was convicted of aiding and abetting a terrorist.
Well, so were several of the other women were convicted of things too, like Eve Adams and Mae West.
Right. And, you know, the reason I chose to put her in there in the category of crooks is, again, you know, asking ourselves to reflect on these terms and the language of it and what they mean exactly. But Lynn Stewart was sort of a hero to a lot of lefty people in New York because she would defend people accused of crimes, men accused of shooting cops, and she had a lot of admiration for people in the law. However, once she started representing the Blind Sheikh was considered so dangerous by federal authorities that they explicitly told her that during visits with him, she would not be allowed to relay messages out of the jail cell to the public because any words from him would be perceived by his followers as orders or instructions. And she was instructed about this. She agreed to it. She signed a document agreeing that she wouldn't do it, and then she did it.
Nevertheless, she persisted.
That's right. And as a result of that statement, there were several violent acts committed in which people died. And so, you know, I'm in no position to judge whether she was responsible for those deaths or not, but it is clear that she violated the law and she was convicted of that. And then after doing that, she got up and said that she would do it again. And because she did not show remorse, they increased her punishment. And because of her health, she developed breast cancer. She was released early. But, you know, I hope, even though it's very short, I try and sort of look at the complexity of that situation. And, you know, it raises real challenges, how we think about her in our, in how history books will think about her.
She did just pass away earlier this month. And so
I didn't know that. Yeah.
So I'm happy to mention her this morning. Is there anyone, now that the book is out, right, that it is a fait accompli, you have done this thing, is there anyone that you have thought, damn, if only I really wish I had included this woman?
Oh, you know, there were a bunch of those before I even
finished the book. You probably have a list.
So yeah, I have lists of women. So, you know, I would have liked to include Dorothy Day, who was a Catholic worker and activist. I would have liked to include Alice Austin, who was another photographer who lived in Staten Island. Her work was kind of discovered after her death. It wasn't very influential during her time. She was, despite her Victorian upbringing and resources, she liked to hang out on the street and be a photographer. She visited Ward's Island and some different islands where new immigrants were held because they were sick. And she also photographed lesbian relationships at home and tried to kind of show more normality in depictions than existed at the time. She was very relaxed. She was very brave. She was the first woman on Staten Island to own and drive a car. she was cool, and I would have loved to include her, too. That's the problem. I could have kept going. There could have been 10 volumes. Who knows? Maybe there will be.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to fit all these great women into one book. But how many women do you have in this book?
I think all told, there's 128, about 30 of whom are living, and the rest are deceased. And they span from the 1700s to current times. So there's one woman in there who was a refugee from England. She didn't like how the king treated her because of her religious beliefs, and she fled there and had the great misfortune of landing in what is now Massachusetts among the Puritans.
I know.
Who
Wrong
were
move.
Even more unforgiving than the king, and so she left there and struck out on her own and came to what is now Brooklyn and settled the town of Gravesend, which is still in existence today.
Excellent.
So I had one person from the 1600s, one from the 1700s, and then a lot more beginning in the 1800s.
I love that you have the two of the chapters. There's Loudmouths and Wisecrackers. And I love that in particular because, of course, women are not supposed to be loudmouths or wisecrackers.
Well,
wise
you know,
and
I love the loudmouths. No,
but we're talking about, but we're talking New Yorkers, so.
Exactly. I mean, who embodies a New Yorker more than Bette Midler? I mean, Bette Midler, not only has she always been very outspoken about what is right and treating everybody with dignity, but now she's become this fierce tweeter. Is tweeter a word? But she's on Twitter all the time, and she sends out these terrific tweets that are both hilarious and heart-wrenching, and I love following her.
Twitter is a great place for wisecrackers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, wisecrackers, you know, when you look at the history of the city's comedians, a lot of them were really pioneering, and comedians often play a central role in sort of changing society because they get us to laugh about the difficult things. So in some cases, they make inroads that other people can't. So Joan Rivers was such an important person in comedy history. I mean, she went on television at a time where you couldn't even say the word abortion on TV, and she was making abortion jokes. And people forget how remarkable that was and how significant that was. I mean, I think a lot of the younger comedians today don't forget that, and Amy Schumer actually did a tribute to her at one point because she had so much respect for how brave Joan Rivers had been. But Fannie Brice is also in there. You know, her.
Speaking of brave women.
Well, she was brave, and her she was so funny. You know, her Follies was just so funny that, and the success of that moved it to Broadway and really was part of the foundation of Broadway. You know, the show was so big, and it attracted loads of people, and then it attracted producers who wanted to make more shows like that. So, you know, when you think of Broadway history, her name doesn't usually come up, but that's something I wanted to make sure she got credit for.
Absolutely. We are talking with Julie Scalfo. You are listening to Positively Revolting here on KBOO, your community radio station. I want to let you know, coming right up on KBOO, 9 o'clock, One Land, Many Voices, talks to the parents of Rachel Corrie on this, the 14th anniversary of her death in Palestine. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, headlines, interviews, and commentary, all packed on to 15 minutes. Dennis Bernstein brings us flashpoints at 10:15, and then at 11 o'clock, it's Pacific Underground, covering the stories of Asians and Pacific Islanders in Oregon. Tonight on the KBOO Evening News at 5 o'clock, there'll be a closer look at ICE activities in Portland, and a report on how Oregon high schools are dropping the ball on athletic injuries. We want to thank all KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not currently a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. You know, we do pretty much exist on your contributions. So do please support what you listen to.
Don't be shy.
Step right up.
Give us some money.
Become a member of KBOO today. We are talking with Julie Skelfo. She is the author of The Women Who Made New York. She's going to be making her first trip to Portland. So we want to make sure that Julie feels welcomed in Portland. As she'll be speaking at Powell's on Sunday.
Burnside.
Powell's on Burnside. Sunday evening, 7:30.
And I'll be shopping there. I'm so excited.
Oh, then you want to get there like 5 or 6 hours early because really
I'm a book buyer, collector, and by collector, I mean I buy more books than I can ever possibly read. But
I know that feeling.
Check it out.
Well,
bring
an extra suitcase.
It's not called Powell's City of Books for nothing.
I know.
We just have about 10 minutes left. Let's go ahead and talk to Camilo. Good morning, Camilo.
Hi, Julie. Welcome to Portland.
Thank you.
I have a question, which I was reluctant to raise because it's kind of boring and abstract. But since you mentioned Buddhism yourself, I'm going to ask the question. And I'm asking it because I'm a Buddhist practicing for the past year. And I've taken on the tendency to look at things as whether they're Buddhist or not Buddhist. So what I'm interested from you is hearing a kind of succinct frame of the conceit, the philosophical conceit that underlies this book. And there are three concepts you mentioned, compassion, perspective, and dignity, that I think fit into the Buddhist aspect of what I'm hearing from you.
I love this question. Why would you have hesitated to call in? I mean, look, I mean, I, as a journalist, I've spent my whole career keeping myself out of the story. You know, it's our job to be nonpartisan, to, be unbiased. But the reality is that everybody has biases, no matter what you are. If you are 5'6 or 6'1, you're going to see things around you slightly differently. And so I think the goal as a journalist is to try and recognize your bias and try and make it clear to your reader. And so in this case where I had to kind of make judgments about what New York City is, I realized there's a million ways to define New York City, and so I wanted to do that for my reader in a way that made clear how I see New York. And my introduction does kind of reveal a little about my life and my perspective on New York. But all of my work, you know, my bias has always been that I want all people to be treated with dignity. So every story I've ever done, I've tried to treat everyone with respect, no matter their title or no title, no matter if they were a small actor in the event or the main figure. And, you know, I don't understand why that really is a controversial thing. As a human being, you know, as an employee of major news organizations, I've always agreed that I would not participate in political activity. And there are good reasons for that. However, this January, I made the decision to go ahead and march in the Women's March because I felt like the message of this march was exactly what we're talking about, which is treating everybody with dignity. And the person who was, you know, elected as President of the United States was making direct statements of hate speech towards many different groups in our society. And just as a human being, I could not do nothing about that. I felt like I had to stand up and take a position on that, and so I did. And so one of the nonprofit groups that I'm a huge fan of is called Narrative 4, and they work on something called a story exchange where they go into communities, usually high schools, and they help people meet in a circle, and you pair up and you share your story privately with the other person, and then when you come back to the group, the other person has to take your story and tell it in the first person to everyone else. And in the process of doing this, this amazing sort of experience of empathy takes place. And that sort of care and concern for other people. I mean, it's the golden rule. I don't really associate it with any one religion, but that's what is sort of bolstered in Narrative Four's work, which I love. And what I hope I did in my book, The Women Who Made New York, is try and show that kind of empathy and let people get into the shoes of these women from all different backgrounds, from all different centuries, and sort of understand what they faced and what they contributed. I mean, the people I admire most are women like Audre Lorde, who were brave enough to kind of own their own human experience, whatever it was, and encourage other people to be brave and do that too and treat others with dignity. So, you know, that's the challenge to us in human civilization, is to be able to tolerate differences and accept them. I mean, that is the Buddhist non-judgment. And so I admire your practice. Good luck to you. I'm not a formal Buddhist, but I've studied it a little bit and try and incorporate some of the practices into my own life.
Well, as a reformed New Yorker, I appreciate your response.
Thanks very much,
Camila. I heard
Camila.
There were a lot of New Yorkers out there in Portland.
Oh, yeah.
It's
reformed
true.
Reformed New Yorker. Reformed means what? You're more patient and polite now, I hope?
Well, yeah, that is, I think, a feature of Portland. It was really shocking here when I came from New York to find people smiling at me, and I wondered, well, what do they want?
Thanks very much for your call, Camila. We are just about out of time. I want to thank Julie for being with us. And one more time, you are going to be here in Portland at Powell's on Burnside this Sunday.
Sunday night, 7:30 at Powell's. I can't wait. I'm actually also doing an event on Monday at the, I want to say this right, Multnomah Athletic Club?
Multnomah.
Yeah, it's private. I think it's for members only, but I was really grateful to be invited there, so I'm looking forward to meeting people Monday, too.
All right, and we have just about 1 minute left. Any parting thoughts on your work this morning, things that you really want our listeners to hang on to?
Well, you know, the book is about women who made New York City, but I think, as I said before, a lot of the things that they made, whether it was justice movements or the fight to help children get education and health care that they need, these works that the women did in New York City have had an effect on us all over the United States, and I think they're still a source of inspiration. It takes our society a long time to figure out how to be civilized, and we're still working on it, and I hope people will be inspired by these women, because I sure am.
All right. Thank you, Julie. So much, Julie.
Thanks for having me. You're
absolutely.
Welcome.
It's been a delight to talk to you.
Take care.
And with that, we make way. One Land, Many Voices, coming right up in about 2 minutes. Stay tuned to KBOO all day long for your oral needs.
And stay positively revolting.
There comes a time when every second